Hi there, folks, and welcome to the Photo Wild Podcast.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. We created the Photo Wild Podcast to blend together the art and science of wildlife photography. Each episode brings you stories from the field, from the technical considerations to the natural history of the subjects we work with. If you want to become a better wildlife photographer, then this is the podcast for you. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Photo Wild Podcast. Of course, you know who I am. My name is Jared Lloyd.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And we are your esteemed hosts for this show. So thank you for coming back once again and suffering through all of our nerdgasms and talking about all the technical stuff about wildlife photography. And should we just go ahead and say it, the art and science of it all?
It's true. I don't know about esteemed, but we are really glad to have you back here listening to the podcast. And we had such a great response to our last episode talking more about our floating blinds that this episode is going to dive a little bit more into a situation where we used our floating blinds and the different, you know, elements of photography that came from it. And all we've got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about today. And so I'm really excited about this episode, Jared.
Yeah, I am too, actually. The concept of using things like floating blinds, right? It's such a unique way to go about photographing wildlife. And you and I talk about this sort of thing all the time, how that more often than not, it's the ancillary equipment. It's the stuff that has absolutely nothing in the world to do with our cameras or lenses or the stuff made by Nikon, Sony, Canon, you know, stuff like that.
Basically. And Olympus. We didn't forget about you, Olympus shooters.
And, oh, yes. Sorry about that, Olympus shooters. And Olympus. It's the things not made by these companies that are oftentimes the most important pieces of equipment for us out there. So North Dakota, why on earth are we in North Dakota? Most people, unfortunately, think of places like the Dakotas as the great flyover states. Yep. You know, it's nothing but corn and soybeans, and for good reason. You know, drive across these states, that's kind of more or less what you see nowadays. These giant, you know, agricultural industrial complexes, if you will. But the Dakotas are actually some of the most species-rich and biologically diverse states in North America, in the United States, and, you know, kind of the continuation of those ecosystems and habitats on up into Canada as part of that, of course, right? And so when I think of North Dakota, when I think of wildlife in North Dakota, first and foremost, I think of a place called the Prairie Potholes region. And so the Prairie Potholes, this is an area that does extend from Canada south, basically. So starting up in northern Alberta, it's kind of like a big swath that comes down and across Saskatchewan, dips down into northern Montana, encompasses literally almost all of the Dakotas, of course, North and South Dakota, and then kind of, you know, a little piece of western Minnesota there.
Yeah.
And so take Minnesota, for instance, right? The very same reason that Minnesota has 10,000 lakes is the same reason that these other places have millions and millions of little ponds and sloughs and lakes and stuff like that. And it's because of the last ice age. It's because of the Laurentide Glacier, or kind of continental ice sheet, basically, that kind of dipped down into this region. And then as it withdrew, left behind all of these divots in the Earth's crust. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the, you know, let's say the pock marks on a golf ball, if you will. Grasslands as far as the eye can see. And so where we have these ponds, all of a sudden we end up with these little tiny oases of life, of water. You know, all life needs water to some respect. And so, you know, it's kind of like that Field of Dreams concept, right? You know, build it and they will come. So the glaciers built it, you know, all these little ponds across the prairie, essentially. And the wildlife comes in droves. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is truly one of the most amazing places, I think, in North America to photograph if you're in photographing birds. Which, Annalise, tell us all about how much you like to photograph birds.
Fun fact, I am absolutely a bird nerd. You can always talk birdie to me and I'll enjoy it. I actually think I have a shirt that says
that. You do have that shirt.
Has a shirt that says that. But I absolutely love photographing birds. And, you know, I grew up in northern Wisconsin where we also have glacial potholes. And so I've always been drawn to this. And even like where I grew up, there's some more grassland style potholes as well. But it's nothing like the Dakotas, where you have this vast open land and you have this really just beautiful light, and it's just a truly unique spot. And so for me, what I enjoy most about photographing birds is understanding the unique habitat and why those birds are in this specific spot to begin with. We've talked about this before in our podcast, like in the moose episode, what makes a Maine moose different from a Yellowstone moose, different from an Alaska moose, right? It's the same thing with some of these birds, the set and the setting and where they're located and their habitat and the challenges they face in the habitat are all part of the unique stories of each species. So I love photographing birds, but I especially love photographing them in different locations like this because the story of where they live and why they need this spot so desperately is a really important story to tell.
And, you know, when we talk about how important that story is to tell, right? Like, I don't think that we can talk about the prairie potholes region and birds without talking about, well, just basically species decline. This study, it was a metadata study that took years, to conduct. But what they found is that today there are 3 billion birds less in the skies than when you and I grew up as kids.
Like in our lifetime, they've declined that much.
With inside of our lifetime, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I grew up in the 80s. You grew up kind of sort of in the 70s there. and, you know, so even in with inside of that short period of time, there are 3 billion less birds in North America today than there were at that point in time. And while the declines that we're seeing with avian life like this, you know, are found, you know, across all habitats, all biomes in North America, the one that is the hardest hit right now are the grasslands, the prairies. Yes. Like this. And so we are now looking at somewhere around 55% of all of the birds inside of the prairie potholes are in decline, in massive decline. And so, yeah, when we think of 3 billion birds missing, the lion's share of those birds are coming from this area that we are talking about, the prairie potholes region and the greater prairies at large. And so that was kind of the impetus for us to stop off in the prairie potholes and spend some time with our floating blinds working in this place. Now, I feel like in so many ways we've learned from, you know, the mistakes and, dare I say, crimes of, you know, the 19th century. You know,
some
of them, at least, yes, yes, when it comes to protecting wildlife. But unfortunately, you know, when we think about a place like the prairie potholes region, you know, while the species themselves are protected, so much of the habitat is not, unfortunately.
Right.
And that is the biggest problem that faces, you know, these grassland species nowadays, especially in an area that is so dry. And then suddenly you have these little oases again of water, essentially. So, you know, that, you know, while we all need to eat, you know, and, you know, you love your corn, for instance, and I love my beef, you know, it's the problem is this kind of industrial agricultural complex that sweeps across the prairies, you know, is now the biggest threat to so many of these species, mm-hmm. whether it's draining of wetlands or just toxifying the water from insecticides,
all the runoff,
you know, the fertilizer runoffs into these wetlands and the algae blooms that kind of, you know, result. And so let's talk about some of these species, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
let's
we've already said that, like, yes, let's talk about the birds themselves.
I love talking about birds. Let's get to it.
You know, there were redheads. There were blue-winged teals. My God, the ruddy ducks.
Oh,
the ruddy
gosh.
Ducks were so incredibly beautiful. And talk about peak breeding plumage. I mean, just gorgeous.
For all of them.
We got so many incredible photographs of these different species. But I think you and I both walked away saying, like, you know, wow, the Western grebes and the eared grebes were really the thing that us, you know, that we individually found ourselves kind of targeting while we were out there.
Yeah, we were both captivated. If you remember, too, like going up there, both the Western grebe and the eared grebe at that point in time were lifers for me. And I remember we were driving from one part and coming through North Dakota, and we were specifically on the lookout for where we might find the best locations. Along this, you know, swath of freeway, like kind of coming off into these different, you know, waterfowl production areas and other places that we are allowed to photograph without a lengthy permit process and whatnot.
Or finding permission on private land,
right,
and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Right, exactly. And so, and that is a key thing to think about, is you can't just go anywhere you want to, right? So we had to find these places that we could go without a lot of extra conditions. And I remember saying to you, like, I just really want to see a Western grebe. And I was like, I just really want to see one. I'm just so excited to see one. And we turned the corner and then I was like, oh my God, there are 70 Western grebes.
Yeah, I remember that. It was like, it was pouring down rain. We're in these like this clay mud sort of like road. I'm in like lockdown and four wheel drive. We literally had a U-Haul trailer behind us.
We did.
And it's like, you know, no, this is probably a really stupid thing to do, but Annalise wants her Western grebes. So we're going to try and find her a Western grebes.
I mean, this
poor U-Haul trailer, like, caked in like a foot of mud all the way around it, you know,
worth
and yeah,
it,
you're right. We come
it.
Over this hill and around this corner and like, yeah, there was 70 Western grebes just spread across. And we were hoping to see like one or two.
I was just excited to maybe see any of them. But
I'm thinking that like every wildlife photographer that lives in North Dakota right now is like, shut up.
I know.
Don't tell people about this.
Right.
We have it all to ourselves.
No kidding. And actually, you and I did have this place all to ourselves when we finally got out there. We never saw another photographer at all out there. Mm-hmm. But then we saw the eared grebes. And then the first day in the water, I saw my first red-necked grebe. There was just one who was like in there for a little bit.
And now I was covered up with them. They're in like
every, I know, now they're everywhere
ditch,
in Alaska.
You know, swamp, but marsh up here
in Alaska. Yeah, I was in birder heaven. Like, honestly, I was just like every which way felt like a lifer for me. And I was so excited. And so seeing the bird for me is always a joy, whether I have my camera or I don't. But photographing them takes it to the next level for me. And so, like you said, we found a spot that we fell in love with and that produced for us every single day.
Yeah. And so, you know, most of the prairie potholes are literally, as the name implies, they're like potholes. There are these little kettles. There are these little holes out in the prairies, essentially, which rounds, ringed in cattails. That's about it. They have birds, but they're relatively limited. Each one is going to have a couple breeding birds, you know, excluding, of course, the various species of blackbirds, like the red-winged blackbirds or the yellow-headed blackbirds, you know. But we isolated our time. We decided to concentrate our time, I should say, in one of the bigger sloughs, kind of sluggish, marshy, swampy area that connected several of these potholes. So that way we could really take advantage of the relatively short amount of time that we had to work this and get the greatest number of species.
Right.
But, you know, the thing for me with the Western grebes, first and foremost, if you're not familiar with these birds, when it comes to grebes, they're actually quite large. You know, they're bigger than any duck you've ever photographed. They're kind of like, I would almost say they're like a skinny, tiny little swan almost with these super long necks and kind of black caps to their heads, basically, right? And the Western grebe specifically has like a black mask that comes down its face and these red eyes, and that mask is really the thing that sort of differentiates it from the Clark's grebe, you know, a little bit further west, of course, actually, you know, in Montana and places like that where I've lived. The neck of these birds are so incredible. And it's amazing how this species of bird has come to utilize that long neck for communication amongst its species. And, you know, so it's pretty cool. Like, ornithologists actually consider the mating ceremonies of the Western grebe to be one of the most complex of any species of bird in the world. Now, think about that for a second. I mean, everybody listening to this is probably familiar with like birds of paradise, for instance.
Yeah.
You might be familiar with sage grouse, the greater sage grouse, and the kind of crazy leks that the males come onto with the, you know, well, we won't
puffed
go into
breasts
that.
And yeah, all the exactly. showy. Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a different episode. But when you think about the 10,000 plus species of birds on Earth, the Western grebe is considered to have one of the most complex mating kind of set of mating rituals, if you will. And so, you know, some people refer to them as ceremonies. I think most of the ornithological literature refers to them as ceremonies, but kind of colloquially, they're usually just known as dances. And so probably the two most known dances or ceremonies or whatever you want to call this stuff for these Western grebes is going to be the rushing ceremony and the weed ceremony. And I always want to say weed dance personally. And so if you've ever seen
a weed ceremony, sounds like it belongs in a movie, like some sort of random,
like a Cheech and Chong movie.
Yeah, Cheech and Chong movie. The weed ceremony.
Yeah, the weed
ceremony dance.
That happens in Colorado on April 20th.
Right.
So yes, the weed dance. Maybe that's why I like weed dance a little bit better. Although that does too kind of sound like a Grateful Dead.
Who
show.
Knows? Right.
We could keep going with this. So if you've ever seen pictures of these kind of like big white birds on the water that suddenly like stand up on top of the water and literally kind of like basilisk lizard or Jesus lizard it a across the surface of a pond. That is the Western grebe. So they literally stand up on the surface of the water and they paddle their feet so fast that it has them running across the surface. And they do this in tandem, side by side each other. And it is, it is one of the coolest things you will ever see.
It's spectacular.
With birds in North America.
Like,
it's
truly spectacular.
Truly amazing. And then of course the weed dance, yeah, the Russian dance or the Russian ceremony, it's probably the most spectacular, but I love the nuances of the weed ceremony itself, where, they're probably like 15 meters apart from each other. They start bobbing their heads, they start rolling their necks back, and then they both dive down and, synchronized diving almost, and they come back up with these beaks full of just vegetation from the bottom of the pond, and they swim over to each other, and then they both kind of somehow manage to kick their way standing straight up on top of the water again, and they cross their beaks kind of like, it looks like they're swapping beaks full of weeds essentially, but they're not, and they kind of tap their beaks back and forth essentially until one of them throws their weeds, the other throws their weeds, and then they swim off, and then they usually go and mate someplace basically. Just one of the most unbelievable species of birds that you'll ever have the opportunity to photograph. And quite frankly, I would argue that the only way you're ever going to find yourself in a situation where you can enter into the world of this bird to actually see these just extraordinary ritualistic ceremonies that they have is from a floating blind, actually. This is not something that you would ever be able to do, I think, at least from standing on the bank of a pond or something like that, or on the bank of the slough. These are larger birds. They're fish specialists. There's a bunch of cool, crazy adaptations that they have, for kind of protecting their guts from the fish bones that they eat by, swallowing feathers and stuff like that. But this is a bird that needs larger bodies of water to be able to survive a pond. That's ultimately ringed in marsh. So that way, the food source that they have, the fish, has habitat for themselves, but they also have nesting habitat and stuff like that. And so it's just not an area that you would ever going to really be able to easily access otherwise. But from a floating blind, it allows us to enter right into their world. And the curiosity that these birds showed our blinds was just mind-blowing.
So I think you touch on something here too that's worth chatting about, which is like the floating blind is a much better setup than a kayak. We have a lot of photographers who love to kayak and do a lot of kayak photography. We do it as well. We've been out photographing loons in our kayaks, for instance. And that's another situation where if we were in kayaks, those birds would not be relaxed enough to partake in this ritualistic behavior. They would be very on guard. They would be very, very aware of our presence. They would see our human predator shape. They would recognize that this is not a normal situation. Whereas in the floating blind, there is nothing about that setup that shows us as predators. There's nothing about that setup that's threatening. They're not going to see us move around at all.
Let's go back to the search image.
So, exactly. And so that is why for something as unique as this particular ritual is, you really need a floating blind or something similar where you can have complete and total just disappearance in your human form factor and in everything else and really blend into that environment, because these rituals, especially at such a sensitive time of year, breeding season, etc., are so crucial to the species and their behavior. You just aren't going to see that if you're trying to hide on the side of the shore, if you're out in your kayak, very obviously, in the space as an intruder. With our floating blinds, we blend in as part of the environment to the point that the birds are continuing 100% of their behavior as if we aren't even there at all. We melted so much into that landscape that the birds came our way. And or at least, that was my experience, where I didn't have to go to the birds. They were just so relaxed and just doing their thing that, I didn't really have to try to get into a spot with them. They just kept bringing the activity closer and closer and closer.
Well, that's what I was saying. And they were so curious. It seems like they were coming over to literally just check us out.
They were interested in it, but it didn't go on the radar of us being anything other than a muskrat hut or something that should be there.
Or a blown away, a cheap Walmart tent. That's probably why they came over to me. They're like, what is this weird tent floating around out here? Whose backyard did this blow out of?
Right.
It's the runaway Walmart tent, basically, that's camouflage floats.
At least it's not a fashion contest.
At least it's not a fashion contest.
So that's okay.
So while the Western Grebes were probably, you know, my favorite of all of the birds, and I recognize that, you know, that was one of the big kind of targets for you. You were just hoping to be able to even see one, mm-hmm. let alone photograph one. You know, once we got out in there in the water and we started photographing these birds, I think it was the eared grebe that really kind of stole the show for you specifically.
Absolutely. So I wasn't even sure we would see eared grebes. And then I have to say, like, I think most of my close-up moments with the eared grebes were some of my favorite moments. Like, I just saw more of them and had more of a chance to interact with them. And grebes in general are just such a cool species of bird, right? Every grebe is fascinating to me, whether it's a pied-billed grebe, I love their little scoots, you know, to these grebes, which have these, you know, the Western grebes has this really, like, they have this crazy elaborate mating ritual. And then with the eared grebes, I was just absolutely blown away by their beautiful dark feathers with the gold ear feathers and the bright red eye. I mean, they're just stunning, stunning birds. And in my case, I couldn't get enough of watching their behavior. And as a bird watcher and photographer, and I don't like to say that they're necessarily separate things, but, like, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot. We are often very much just observing of behavior as much as we are taking photographs. Like, we're learning a lot when we're not behind the lens, when they're too close to photograph, et cetera.
Well, that was like last night, right?
You know, we
were up, you know, above tree line and we were watching a grizzly, you know, and it's like we spent probably 2 hours just sitting behind the binoculars, you know, watching this guy. And we talked about it several times. It's like, you know, when you're behind the camera, you're not learning anything.
Exactly.
You're so tuned in to trying to create your photographs. It's when you put your camera down and you're able to step back and observe and watch and study, that's when you're actually learning about the subjects out there. And if I can, real quick here, mm-hmm. right, you know, because we have podcast listeners, you know, from the UK and, you know, Australia, various
yes.
places around the world. So I should just say this real quick. The eared grebe that you're talking about, that is actually the most abundant species of grebe on the planet. They actually mm-hmm. there's 55 different names for this species. It's just here in North America, they're called eared grebes. But for anybody listening, you know, let's say across Europe, you might be familiar with this species as the black-necked grebe.
Yes. And whatever they are called, they are just absolutely stunning birds. And you and I both managed to photograph them a lot at golden hour, especially with that beautiful sunset. And
they were definitely my favorite with that low golden side light coming through the marsh.
Yes. And then it hits the golden ear tufts that they have. It really bounces off that beautiful red eye. I mean, everything about these birds is stunning in that light.
Let's, if you're cool with this, let's jump into how animals utilize the habitat. Because, I mean, quite frankly, everybody listening to this, they can jump on a blog someplace, they can watch a YouTube video. Somebody's going to be mouthing off about, you know, autofocus systems and, you know, and things like that. But nobody's ever talking about how animals are utilizing their habitat. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, quite frankly, it's so much more important than, you know, mastering an autofocus system. It's so much more important than having the latest, greatest, fanciest, most sophisticated, you know, professional level camera and stuff like that out there. So when it comes to working in these wetland areas, when it comes to working in water like this from these floating blinds, there is one term that I think every wildlife photographer absolutely positively has to know, and it's called the littoral zone. That's probably not a phrase most people are familiar with, but trust me when I say you're familiar with the concept. You know it when you see it. Let's put it a different way. It's a marsh. It's a bunch of emergent vegetation. You've got water and you've got grass sticking up out of that water, essentially, right? From an ecological perspective, it's just called the littoral zone, but you can literally look at a body of water and you can narrow down, you know, the wildlife activity to that one, say, 10% of that water, that one area of the littoral zone. And you know for a fact that 90% of the activity that you can photograph is going to happen in that one spot, in that one spot only. So I think I mentioned something about this with the Western grebes, right? And like their need for open water, but then having that kind of emergent vegetation, the littoral zone. And, you know, for the Western grebes, ultimately, you know, that has a lot to do with with their food's food, right? And so that's something that we don't think about a lot of times, right? It's like oftentimes, you know, when photographers start to think beyond just the subject and they're like, okay, well, what does my subject eat? Oh, it's a black bear and it wants, you know, white oak acorns, for instance, because it has a higher fat content and a better ratio of fat to protein than the red acorns. And so they're prioritizing this particular species. But to go that step further and ask yourself, well, why do white oaks grow where white oaks grow versus red oaks, you know, for instance?
Exactly.
It's the same thing with this, right? Understanding like what does the food of the Western grebe eat? That's what brings us to the littoral zone, right? So that means that's where the Western grebes are going to be as well. That means that's where the eared grebes are going to be. That's where the blue-winged teal are going to be. That's where, you know, even species like the redheads, oftentimes considered to be a diving duck, you know, that's also where they're going to be spending the vast majority of their time. And not only is that where their food sources are kind of located, but it also gives them protection. Remember, every one of these species are also a prey species, technically speaking. And so, especially during the middle of the day, when they're sleeping or whatnot, you know, they need to kind of tuck themselves up, hide themselves, things like that. They're going to go to these areas. This is also the place where they're going to be nesting as well. So that's why I say 90% of the wildlife, you know, kind of activity is all going to be around this one particular spot. And when we look at a pond, when we look at a lake, you know, usually you'll find that there's only one or two kind of areas with these littoral zones around there, the emergent vegetation or the kind of marshy areas, if you will.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I was going to say, like, the same thing with the eared grebes, right? Mostly aquatic insects. Aquatic insects tend, I mean, yes, are there some in the middle of the lake? Sure, of course there's some. But you tend to see a lot more of those insects around the lily pads, around the grasses, around all of the different things that are on the surface of the water. And so it really does help to know exactly where you should prioritize those spots. We knew that we're not going to go just like in the middle of the lake and look for what we're looking for. Let's go over here to this pocket where the marsh is. So it just helps you prioritize where you should look first so that you don't paddle around an entire lake and not, you know, and not find anything and then wonder why you're not finding anything. Well, you got to think about the habitat. You got to think about the food. You got to think about the food's food. You got to think about the time of year. What are they eating? What are they prioritizing? What does that safe habitat look like? Where do they nest if you're looking for nesting birds? You know, how long are their chicks going to be nearby? Like all of these little tiny things. This is exactly why we talk so much about the natural history and the ecology and the habits and the habitat of the species, whether it's megafauna like brown bears or, you know, birds that specialize in the prairie potholes of North Dakota. It never is not important.
If you want to be a better wildlife photographer, you've got to become a better naturalist.
Absolutely.
That's all there is to it.
Once you start to know this kind of habitat or understand what your target species, what they live in, what they need, what they thrive upon, and how they think and feel about their environment and what they need to survive and thrive, once you get into that habit, it just becomes so much easier to find what you're looking for. And I think even like on our workshops, we get a lot of people like, how do you know where to find these animals? And it's like, yes, we absolutely do a ton of scouting on our own, but we don't just drive around and hope we're going to find something. We're very specific about what we target, when we target that area, why we target that. We're not going to the prairie potholes in November. We're going in spring. There's a reason for that. We're not going out to these locations at this season hoping to find what's actually not going to happen until summer. You know, all of those things come into play. And once you put as much effort into being a better naturalist as you do about understanding, you know, crop sensor versus full frame or whatever you tell yourself is really important about photography and the technical aspects, understanding this will help you level up far faster than any technical thing you can find. If you want to find and photograph animals, birds, any sort of wildlife, you have to know where they are. If you can't find them where they are, you're not going to photograph them.
Yeah. If you can't find the animals, you can't be a wildlife photographer. Right. It's really just as simple as that.
Nobody wants to be that person who everyone says, go to this one lake at this one spot and get the same shot that everybody else does. If you want to find some truly unique situations, you got to get out there and actually work a bit to find those unique situations.
This is what takes all of the hypothetical randomness out of wildlife yes. photography. The movements of animals on a day-to-day basis, there's nothing random about that. It's not happenstance that you found one here versus, you know, over there, essentially. They're there for very specific reasons. And we can kind of distill all of that down to, you know, basically food, sex, protection, mm-hmm. right? You know, let's say the Maslowian hierarchy of needs for wildlife right there, right? Sure. You know, and so, yeah, when it comes to working with these different species of water birds, the wetland areas, the littoral zones, the marsh, the emergent vegetation, whatever you want to call it, absolutely, you know, I'm going to always prioritize those areas over anything else, yes. you know, on those bodies of water, whether I'm sitting in a kayak or whether I'm, you know, walking along in a bank or I'm sitting or standing, as the case really is, inside of a floating blind. And it's just because that's where life happens along these bodies of water, is inside of the littoral zones. So we've talked about, you know, how these animals utilize habitat, and like, my God, you and I literally could write books about this. And I guess, quite frankly, I do write books about this. But I think that, like, maybe we should kind of move on.
I was going to say, you write anthologies about this, not just books. But yes, we need to move on to some of the photography stuff.
Of encyclopedias.
I was going to say, before we lose everybody, we should talk about one of the big reasons they're here, which is the photography part of it.
Well, that is the photography
part. It is, but yeah, absolutely.
I know what you're getting at. Let's yes. talk about the autofocus systems. And I think that this is a really good topic for this particular podcast, because you and I approached our autofocus strategies very differently mm-hmm. from each other. And I think that it had something to do with, you know, the type of equipment that we were using. Obviously, we were using two different size lenses. We were using two different types of blinds. And so we were approaching our subjects completely different. So, you know, I kind of went on and on and on about, you know, littoral zones and all that sort of stuff. So, Annalise, why don't I let you kind of, you know, start the conversation here about autofocus. So why don't you tell everybody, you know, what your strategy was out there?
Okay. So there's a couple of things, and you mentioned a few things that were very different, but the other things that I think come into play here is our height dictated a lot about where we could go. So I'm only
a foot taller than you.
Yeah, I'm 5'6". On my best day,
okay, so I'm not a foot taller. But
well, you're still a solid
6'3".
Yeah, so you're still a 9-inch difference, which is considerable when you're in the water and you're thinking about waist deep in chest waders, right? So we have a height difference. We both were using different blinds at the time. So mm-hmm. I was using my more injection molded style.
The heavy blind.
The heavy blind, the floating hide that we talked about in the last episode. You were using the one that's built on more two pontoons. So we had a lot of different variables that went into this. Now, for me, the heavier blind is very stable. Is it monopod or tripod stable? No. But unless there's like a significant wake or a really big wind, like creating some actual wavy waves, like wakey waves, some wavy waves.
What?
yeah, I know. It's maybe I haven't had enough caffeine today. I don't know. Either way, it's pretty stable. It doesn't really move a whole lot. There's not a lot of bouncing to it. It's a very stable platform for me to work with. And I was shooting, like you said, with a 400. 2.8 lens on my Sony A1. And then I added the 1.4 teleconverter to that. So I was essentially at 560 millimeters with an F4 lens for most of the photography I did there. Now, I was truly envious of the photographs that you got, because with an 800, which was, you know, double my lens in a lot of it, double that reach, I could not get as close with my lens. And so I needed to get closer with my body. And the prairie potholes that we were in, I mean, I mentioned this in the last podcast, like I hit my step goal every day because we were able to move around this whole place like pretty much all of the time. Now I stayed in certain pockets, but because I needed to get closer to the birds and I didn't have the same reach that you had, I had to find myself in these situations where I was physically closer to the birds. And so I worked my areas a little bit differently. And with that stable platform, I was using my single point autofocus the majority of the time. I didn't really do a whole lot with tracking. We're in this wide open expanse. The background is a solid 20, 50, 100 feet behind the birds. So I've got a lot of distance to work with. And I didn't have a lot of clutter or distractions for the most part. Now, there were some situations where that absolutely came into play. And I would, you know, use some of the eye tracking, especially when we had some territorial displays, when we had a little more action, that subject tracking worked like a charm. But for the most part, I only use single point autofocus because I didn't find that I needed to have that extra help. The one exception to that was when I was in a depth of water where I wanted to just flip up my articulating screen. And I think most people have articulating screens of some form on the back of whatever brand of camera they use.
Yeah, definitely if they're shooting mirrorless.
Yeah, mirrorless now. And even some of the DSLRs, I think some of the last generation of DSLRs have them as well.
Yeah, but okay.
It's just different.
Let's just pause for a second here. Because yes, that's important, right? Because, you know, if you're photographing macro, if you're photographing landscapes, mm-hmm, then on a DSLR camera, photographing off of the LCD, mm-hmm, right, that's perfectly fine. But the problem is it's a totally different sort of autofocus,
yes,
system, right?
That's
contrast detect instead of the phase detect. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually, believe it or not, more accurate. And I know you know this, Annalise, but I'm just saying this for the benefit of everybody else. I'm getting daggers at the moment. It's the contrast detect is actually infinitely more accurate than the phase detection,
yes,
is, of course, but it's also infinitely slower. That's why it's great for landscape, great for macro, mm-hmm, photography. But if you're shooting wildlife, you're using the phase detection. And so if you're still shooting a DSLR, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this off of the LCD. You should be,
right,
doing it through the viewfinder. But for those of us that have switched to mirrorless, of course, we're using phase detection no matter what. So you can and, you know, should utilize that LCD screen as much as possible.
So the reason I mentioned like even the DSLR, so the only reason I used the articulating screen was when I couldn't get into a physical position to actually look through my camera. And there were a couple of cases. I'm wearing chest waders. I didn't want to bend over enough that suddenly I had the entire water pouring down my chest
and
waders.
And that's why we're going to get dry suits.
Right. And so in this case, using that screen allowed me to keep myself safe. I didn't have water rushing down my waders and causing, you know, my death potentially. I was able to just flip that up and stare at it from my standing height. And then I used the tracking because I could just hit my, you know, AF on button and it would just land, you know, just like right on the eye. So it was not a problem at all with that, but I didn't need it other ways in the camera. I was able to stoop down and I was actually looking through the viewfinder. That's a comfortable position for me. I'm also very bendy and super flexible. If you've been on a workshop, you've seen some of the weird contortions that I get into to kind of get low to the ground. But not everybody's like that and it's not as easy. So that's where that screen can really come in handy. But you had a very different experience with your autofocus.
Yeah, I did. And so, you know, there's two parts to that, right? Like one, all the equipment that you just named, like you spent a couple of minutes describing exactly the type of situation that you were photographing in. Well, mine was actually a little less stable because again, I'm just working with these inflatable tubes. They're light. I can pack the whole thing into the duffel bag of clothing that I carry with me on a trip or something like that, and then set it up in the field and go, you know, but it does come with the cost of being a very lightweight and slightly shakier, wigglier sort of platform out there, right?
A little more reactive.
Little movements create a lot more movement, you know, with my lens than it would with the other kind of floating hide that's made out of the hard plastic, essentially, right? And then the other thing to that, too, is I was shooting with an 800 millimeter lens versus a 400 or a 560, as you were talking about with your teleconverter on. And so with an 800 millimeter lens, of course, little movements, you know, turn into very big shakes,
yes,
you know, just because the compression, the focal length, you know, everything is just so incredibly exaggerated with that, right? But more so, I think this is the most important thing I would like to communicate out of this for how I used my autofocus system. More important than, you know, let's say the slightly more instable or unstable platform that I was working from was actually the simplicity of the situation that you're talking about, right? And so, you know, most of our episodes that we've done so far and where we actually get into the autofocus stuff, we end up talking about why things like subject tracking or eye tracking AF is not the right option for those scenarios, right? Because you have all of these distracting elements. You have, you know, subject tracking, especially the eye tracking, it's all just based upon kind of like pattern recognition, if you will. So, you know, as your camera is trying to read everything within sight inside of that composition and find something that happens to look like an eye or a face, you know, it might grab a hold of twigs, it might grab a hold of a water droplet on a blade of grass or something like that, right? And so there's just a million reasons why we don't use those, you know, and that's why we say that, you know, eye tracking kind of tends to not work just as many times as it does, you know, basically. So it's oftentimes a 50-50 thing with that. But in this situation, it was so simple, right? To your point, you know, it's not like we had this like cluttered foreground that we're trying to shoot through to get to the birds or anything like that, because we're out in the water with them essentially. So you literally just have water, you have bird, you have background. That's it. It doesn't get more simplistic. You know, it doesn't take super sophisticated autofocus systems to be able to handle this, but that is exactly why I used it. That's exactly why I used subject tracking and eye tracking, you know, in this situation, is because that just meant I knew no matter what, my camera was going to nail focus, and it was something I didn't have to worry about. I could focus all of my efforts on composition. I could focus all of my efforts on trying to anticipate the next move of the bird and the behavior and stuff like that. And, you know, and if the bird moved real quick, or if I happened to, you know, step in a little bit of a hole and my blind twisted just a touch or something like that, I didn't suddenly jump onto the background with my autofocus and then have to kind of search all the way back forward and then back out to the bird or whatever. I just knew that the autofocus system was going to hold that bird through that situation the entire time. So it's just a completely different way of looking at it, right? There's nothing right or wrong about either way we approached, you know, the situation. You looked at it, obviously, it's like, why do I need the extra help? This is as simple gets. Like, so I'm just fine doing this. I know the single point focus is going to be, you know, just laser precise, you know, with the focus. And so that's what you were comfortable with. Me, I looked at it as like, well, it's super simple. There's no way my camera can screw this up. Mm-hmm. And so like, so I'm just going to turn it over to the camera then. So that way I can worry about, you know, the other stuff that I want to be more, you know, no pun intended here, focused on, you know, with my attention and stuff like
totally
that, which was composition
intended,
and capturing behavior and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, this really is probably the one situation thus far in our podcast where I'm going to come out of the autofocus closet, if you will, and say, I loved using subject tracking and eye detect autofocus in this situation because I just didn't have to think about it. It just snapped onto that bright red eye of the Western grebe. You know, it just snapped right onto the eye of that eared grebe, or, you know, the face of the redhead duck or the blue winged teal or the canvas backs and, you know, ruddy ducks. And I mean, the, you know, the alphabet soup of waterfowl that we had to work with out there.
No, I actually really liked using, so most of the time I did single point, I liked using the eye autofocus when I was working with pairs of birds and I wanted to prioritize one of the birds over another, for example. And like I kind of mentioned, like a territorial display, we had a couple of times when there were a few pairs, like two or three pairs of Western grebes all in this water, and you would see, you know, they'd be calling, they'd be trying to be finding each other, like the individuals would be trying to find their mate. And then you'd have like a little bit of a territorial dispute. Or if I wanted to selectively focus in that situation on the one bird who was going to do the most action, then I would lock on and let my camera track him around and make sure that I was focusing on what I felt was like the height of that action. But yeah, it was really nice. I can definitely see why you allowed the tracking to do that work for you. I think if I had had a longer lens, or maybe working in the similar scenario to you, then I definitely would have. I was just so close in most of the time, or I should actually say it felt like I was really far away. So it felt like I only had one thing to hit. And with that distance, it didn't complicate anything for me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, even if we were standing side by side, you know, the 560 versus the 800, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got, let's say, a composition where that bird takes up 20%, 25% of the frame or something like that, well, that bird's 50% of the frame for me. And so little movements mean suddenly like the head's out of the frame, you know, or like it turns sideways or profile to us and flaps his wings, you know, oh, now the wings have been clipped off or something like that from that exact same distance. So, you know, I definitely needed to spend more time being, well, just focused on all of the other, you know, kind of elements with inside of the composition there. And so that allowed me to just constantly worry about where the bird was falling with inside of the frame. It allowed me to, you know, to just, you know, focus my attention where it ultimately needed to be there.
Yeah, I think too, that's, you know, the other part, shooting it sounds so weird to say, like, at 560, which was so wide, compared to 800, it's a lot wider.
It is, yeah, compared to an 800.
But I did have more to work with in the frame in terms of, like, more vegetation, more, like, individual pieces that I had to consider with that composition that it could have... I don't think the camera was not sophisticated enough to recognize what I was going for. But I do think, you know, when you do have more in the frame, there's more mistakes that can be made with an autofocus system making those decisions for you versus like what you were talking about where you have, you know, the bird, the subject, taking up so much of the frame that it really, you know, in my case, I just had a lot more inside my composition to work with where it could have jumped to something else. It wasn't cluttery though. It wasn't like in Panama where we've got sticks and leaves and it's, you know, this extraordinarily low light situation or anything like that. It was really a beautiful setup for any photographer. I mean, even a beginner photographer would just kill it in this kind of situation with such a beautiful subject and such an easy background.
Well, that's, you know, that is actually, I think, one of the reasons I'm super excited about the giveaway that we kind of like hinted at in the last episode. You know, for 2024, we were talking about how we're actually going to select a couple subscribers to Photo Wow magazine. We're going to give them floating blinds and take them to one of our hotspots, you mm-hmm. know, out in the Prairie Potholes region and stuff. And it's just, like it's such a cool spot because like, you know, it doesn't matter what the, let's say, skill level is, you know, in terms of, you know, the wildlife photographer that's going to join us or wildlife photographers, plural, I should say, that will be joining us on that trip, right? It doesn't matter because, you know, because of you working from the floating blinds, we are going to be able to get them into these incredible opportunities, the incredible situations, mm-hmm. To where it, I mean, quite frankly, it does become a little bit challenging to mess up.
It's true. And it doesn't require, like, it's not a frustrating situation either. Like, you know, we just finished our Kenai Fjords workshop, right? Super excited about that one for next year. But it was fun to listen to all of these photographers, you know, shooting birds in flight on a rocking boat and not just like lumbering, you know, great blue herons flying by, but like little rocket puffins and, you know, common mirrors and all these birds flying super fast while rocking. I mean, this is nothing like that. It's the total opposite side of the spectrum in terms of complexity. And so it will be really exciting. I think this is truly the kind of place that is so underrated. We don't tend to think about, to your point from the top of the episode, places like North Dakota, South Dakota as these epic wonderlands that they really are.
They're some of my all-time favorite places to spend my time as a photographer.
Yeah, absolutely. Same for me. You know, growing up in northern Wisconsin, not far, like I could get to Bismarck in a day if I really wanted to from where I grew up. I fell in love with the plains. I fell in love with the wetlands. I fell in love with all of these things. And it's always been a little heartbreaking to me that we don't put more attention on this incredible landscape that we have right in the center of the United States. And there's places like this all over the world as well. It's not just limited to, I mean, this particular situation, yes, but there are underrated places that are probably close to everyone who's listening to this and can really find magic moments like what we found in your own backyard.
Yeah, so this, like I said, at the top of the show, this is our second episode that we've done on floating blinds. The first one, we got really into the weeds about the types of blinds we like to use and stuff like that. This one, we talked a little bit about the subjects that we are photographing in the field. But if you want to know more about working from floating blinds, you definitely should check out the latest issue of Photo Wild magazine. That's going to be the summer of 2023, where I take a very deep dive into all things floating blinds, from, you know, how to use the topography of the landscape itself to literally funnel and bring the wildlife directly to you. You know, when I said that, like, you know, for instance, the Western grebes would come right to us. That wasn't random. That wasn't happenstance. You know, that was because we specifically set ourselves up in the right locations to where they came to us to check mm-hmm. us out and to do their thing. So we get way into all of the other concepts that are important from photographing from these blinds and why we think that they're truly a revolutionary way for photographers to approach their, well, photography, at least when you're working around the water. But yeah, so definitely check out, like I said, that's going to be the summer 2023 issue of Photo Wild magazine. And thanks everyone for joining us on this episode. And well, Annalise, you've already kind of hinted at what the next episode is going to be about, which is...
I believe.
Think about it. Drum roll.
I was going to say, remember? I believe it's our Kenai Fjords
episode. It's Kenai Fjords. Yes. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing our Kenai Fjords episode next.
And I do want to say, before we sign off, please keep those questions coming. So many of you have sent in questions to info@photowildmagazine.com, and they really help us make sure that we're delivering information that you are asking for. So keep that coming. We love hearing from you. We love hearing your questions. We love hearing your episode ideas. We have pages of notes about them, and we're super excited about it. So stay tuned for the next episode, all about Kenai Fjords and the amazing wonderland that that is. And we will be back with that episode soon.
Well, folks, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can always find us at photowildmagazine.com. And we really look forward to answering your questions. So send those in at info@photowildmagazine.com. I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. See you next time.